I'm Mike Sugimoto. I won't really spend too much time introducing myself. I went to La Brie like an epoch ago, 1979 to 1984, and then actually came to Rochester. So I helped move the Schaefers from their chalet in Switzerland to the home in Rochester here. And then Schaefer died not too long after that. Tell me if you can't hear me. Let me just go like that. Have been now teaching most recently at Pepperdine University and in Asian studies primarily, so modern Japanese history and Asian film. But the kind of the core of my research has been thinking about problems of identity, especially national identity. And so that's where a lot of my teaching and especially the climate that we're in now seems to really overlap quite powerfully with some of the original research ideas I had. And I'm gonna set more of a framework tomorrow morning for all that and how I'm looking at these questions of identity. But today is a much simpler presentation for a workshop. I basically wanted to give you a run through, kind of a bibliography of sorts, of some of the major thinkers of our day, in my estimation. And this is a somewhat arbitrary list. I mean, there are more that I could have put on, so I just kind of stopped when I felt like that was enough, you know. But I'm gonna try to run through and give an idea of why I think they're significant players today. I kind of pose them as countercultural. So they are major figures in the sense that you will find their articles in major newspapers, and they have podcasts that are subscribed to quite broadly, but they tend to run against the mainstream. So it's somewhat of a miracle every time one of them manages to get listed. I'll show you in a minute, but some of them now publish in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, so they are getting recognized, so to speak, and many of them hold university posts, so there's that. So they're not countercultural in the sense of not having any kind of platform whatsoever, but they would see themselves as basically being kind of a minority voice today. And I would say that they're, I wouldn't call them conservative. They don't, if I get to one that is, I can show you that. But for the most part, they're not identifying as a conservative voice. In fact, pretty much the opposite of that. But they are, because of some of their positions, they're given that tag of being conservative, which to them is kind of bizarre, quite frankly. And we can talk about how bizarre that is. But so what I plan to do is just go through these slides. So basically, I have portraits of them with their names. So if you choose to write that down, you can Google that and find out more. Or come see me afterwards, and I can tell you significant places to find their writing and their work. So that's basically what I want to set out to do today. Right? Good. Okay, intellectual roundtable. Hopefully this works. Okay. So, and there's no order to this whatsoever. And I guess the other thing I should say is that, except for a few, they aren't Christians. They aren't what we would consider Orthodox Christians. They are sympathetic to Christianity, but they themselves, I mean, I think the furthest they might go is having a spiritual side or something like that, or have some kind of background, but they themselves are not speaking from, say, a conservative or evangelical Christian position at all. And that, honestly, that tends to be kind of the circles that I've run in. So those are the writers that I've been helped by myself in terms of clarity of thinking about a lot of these very difficult issues today. So to start with. So Thomas Chatterton Williams. And you know, you can interrupt me at any point if something isn't clear enough or loud enough or whatever, and I'll be happy to fill in. So he's an interesting figure. He lives in France. He's an American. I think pretty much all of them except one is an American. So he's an American trained on the East Coast in terms of academics. While he was at, I believe it was Colombia, he met a French gal, and they got married, and so now he's been living outside Paris for the last 10 or 12 years, I think, but very much has a voice in the U.S. So he is actually the one figure that has been picked up recently by The Atlantic, and then occasionally writes for The New York Times as well. So some of them are recognized in that way, even though their ideas are not necessarily compatible with a lot of the publications that they publish in. So I would say the main distinctive about Williams is that he's tackling the issue of race quite strongly. And I'll have more on him tomorrow morning. I have really no quotes from anyone here, so I'm just going to be summarizing their positions. And then you can look them up and see if I've mischaracterized them. But I think for Williams, what I've really been powerfully struck by is, I guess, what you might call deconstructing the notion of race. So it came up in Doug's plenary, where he talked about race essentialism. And that is something that quite a few significant black intellectual, public intellectuals are now focusing on, the idea of deconstructing race. So his mother is white and his father is black. And so he has it running into his own family, so to speak. But what really struck him, I think, was the birth of his first child. And then just picking up the child, who didn't at that time have anything that maybe looked sort of on outward appearance to be black. And then he thought, okay, so what's going on here? You know? And then that kind of did a total kind of mental challenge for him to have to think this through. And what he likes to talk about is, the quote I have tomorrow points out, he uses the word mongrel. And actually, there are a few black public intellectuals that are now doing this as well. They openly, in order to confront this notion of blackness, they're holding on to the idea that there is no such thing as blackness. Okay. And what they mean, I think, by that is, I think Thomas Williams will often say, well, you know, the average African American in the U.S. is probably 18 to 22% white. Okay. So there's nothing really essentially, absolutely one designation or the other in terms of identity. Yes?
So does he use mongrel in a positive sense?
Yes. Yeah, he affirms it in that way. And I don't have another figure listed here, but if you want another name, Camille Foster really does a lot with that. K-M-E-L-E Foster. And he really pushes that quite strongly. But so does Williams. And so they're attracted to that idea that the way to get out of this mess in their minds is simply denying, you know, the absolute attempt to come up with these faulty symbolic kind of systems of white versus black, you know. And I do that in my classes as well, as a way of undoing notions of what does it mean to be Asian, or what does it mean to be Japanese, or, you know. And in a way, it's kind of a matter-of-fact thing, right? Because especially in America, being an immigrant pool, you would think that we would have maybe an easier understanding of how that can be. And I think, and actually, it is that way, but it is getting kind of a wrench thrown into the system now, because we've got a new form of racial essentialism coming into play. So, and given the politics and sensitivities of our time, I can see that it's easier for someone who is, quote, black, to be able to speak into these issues more so, because somehow it's given a ring of authenticity to it, and that's just kind of the cultural framework that we're in. But there's not really any logical reason why it has to be that way. Okay. So if I had another video, I would have shown you Henry Louis Gates Jr., director of the African American Studies program at Harvard. He's got an interesting take on this as well. And he's black. And I don't know if you remember, but he was infamously arrested by, you remember this incident, a Boston police officer who had an Irish background. And he saw Professor Gates trying to get into his own house, but because he didn't have the key, so he was, you know, looking around and trying to get in. And so it looked suspicious to the officer, whose name I can't remember now, but anyway. So he arrested him, and then they had this conflict, landed him in jail. It was during Obama's administration, so he got picked up right away, and then became this kind of hot button issue. But Henry Louis Gates, one of the things I use in my classes sometimes is he'll say, before slaves came to America, there was no such thing as a white person. So he brings out that interdependent by necessity kind of relationship in order to even come up with these poles, you know, that are set in opposition to each other. But the thing in particular that I was referencing is Gates is talking about when he was a student at Yale as an undergrad, and a very famous author was coming who wrote, I forget the title now, but it was about a famous civil rights kind of incident that happened, and then in which unfortunately a black man was killed. It was a true story, and then the person that wrote it up turned out not to be black. Okay, so, and this is Yale, 1970s, so there's already kind of black consciousness movement happening, black power movement, and so a lot of people were attacking this author who was coming to Yale to speak. And Henry Louis Gates, although just an undergrad, that why can't he write about what happened to this black person if he writes it well and if it's well researched and all that? He found the book very, very powerful, and I wish I could remember the name right now, but anyway. So that was an interesting case, but then Gates goes on to very eloquently say, what's to stop me from writing about the Iliad or the Odyssey? Why, because I'm a black man, can I not engage in Western culture? And so already in his mind, and that was a statement he made maybe 10 years ago, I don't know that he would be free to make that statement today because things are so charged right now. But people like Williams are picking it up and others as well. So I'm really quite struck by Williams. So if you want kind of a interesting beginning in how, say, very aware black intellectuals are in coming to terms with this notion of blackness, Williams would be someone to start with, I think. He'd be a good person to begin with. And the recent, not to get into every controversy, but you know, the recent controversy about the use of the N-word and that kind of thing, you know, with the famous Joe Rogan episode, perhaps, if you know about that. So he wrote about that, spoke about that as well, like, why not? I mean, obviously, it's hurtful, triggering, offensive, you know, so yeah, better not to use, or to be highly contextualized, but intellectually there's no logical reason why it can't be talked about. And there's other people, another person I'll get to, that actually wrote a whole essay on the N-word, another black American. So that's Thomas Williams, and he's interesting to me because he writes from Europe. So it's an interesting perspective. I mean, they have their colonial past that's now come into play on the continent, and then we have a very different kind of context for ours as well. But okay, yeah. Actually, he had some interesting remarks about the halftime show, if you're interested in that, too. Okay, yeah. Next. Okay, this is one of my favorites, Chloe Valdery. So, Chloe Valdery, she is probably someone that gets close to affirming a Christian background. I mean, she's very open about it. I would say it's a little quasi, but nevertheless, I wouldn't call it exactly liberal either, but she also affirms a Jewish background. She lived in Israel for a while and did quite a bit of research on the state of Israel and very strongly spoke out for the defense of the state of Israel. So she's an interesting character. She comes from New Orleans, and I think that's part of where she was educated through these Jewish schools, and that's how she was introduced to this whole concept of Jewishness, which she began to affirm as a black woman. But what she began to do is work on this concept of diversity training, and which I guess maybe you've heard of that or are familiar with that, or maybe you've been involved in diversity training sessions. It's pretty unavoidable, I think, in a lot of workplaces today, or certainly in the university. But she developed a whole curriculum called the Theory of Enchantment. The Theory of Enchantment. And it's really taken off. So I'm trying to bring this to the school where I teach, which is Pepperdine, because we're kind of getting involved in all this right now too. I mean, in the last year and a half since George Floyd's death, of course, everyone's trying to start DEI sessions at their institution, whatever. And what she's found is that they're often not very successful, that they seem to create more tribalism. And so she's actually been brought in by corporations as well as universities to basically do damage control for what happened with a disastrous DEI session. So she comes in with her program, and I have one kind of promotional video that she put out. That's the only kind of video here, but I'll show that and then we can talk about that. Let's see. Hopefully there's enough bandwidth that this will work.
It's the middle of the night and you can't sleep, or you're driving on the interstate and a song comes on and it's the most relatable thing you've ever heard, almost as if it's written with you in mind. You've heard it before, but it hits different this time. You just gave birth, you just graduated, you just divorced, or worse or better. Now the song isn't special, but they'll never forget it now because it made sense. Why? Perhaps there's a deeper truth that it contains. But what is it? That's where we come in. Theory of Enchantment is an anti-racism course rooted in developmental psychology that seeks to uncover the immense complexity and potential within each of us. The program dives deep into the art we consume and demonstrates how the themes in much of our pop culture speak to a deeper psychological need that we all have to be loved and accepted. The program is governed by three basic principles. Treat people like human beings, not like political abstractions. Criticize to uplift and empower, never to tear down, never to destroy. And root everything you do in love and compassion. The course guides you through these principles by inviting you to explore the works of some of the most popular and revered writers and musicians in recent memory. Like Human Complexity through the eyes of James Baldwin, or Parental Baggage through the eyes of John Steinbeck. From John Mayer to Lil Wayne, all these artists have at one time or another exhibited the theory of enchantment. While other anti-racist programs whittle people down to caricatures, we seek to create an environment that will foster learning, cooperation, and understanding, and that will teach students to first love themselves, after which they'll be able to love others. Why is this important? Well, because you're a human being, and the human condition is sometimes nice, sometimes painful. But most importantly, it's redemptive, and we cannot escape it. When you practice the theory of enchantment, you'll gain a deeper understanding of yourself and others. You'll be equipped with a sense of wholeness, and this is important, because when we feel whole, we're less likely to gravitate toward extremism. Theory of Enchantment will give you the capacity to move forward through these trying times. So what do you think? Ready to dive in? We've got a free resource for you at the link, and we hope to see you there.
Okay, I want to take her course and go into that session. What I find really interesting is she mixes things up quite a bit. So she's very free to use sort of popular culture as well as, you know, classics like the Iliad, Shakespeare. So she affirms kind of a full spectrum of that. But I think the thing she's most known for is trying to break down kind of this division, this opposition between camps. And if I can summarize her main, I guess, strategy is to try to find the thing that you see is objectionable in the other person and to find it in yourself, right? So she tries to go in that route. And so if you can identify with that person as opposed to disidentifying with that person, that could be a way of forming a bridge. And it may not work in every case, but that is kind of her basic goal. And from what it seems, I mean, it's been highly successful and it's now growing and getting picked up. So I'm really hoping more Theory of Enchantment programs kind of spring up around the country. I'm guessing by the term enchantment that she's kind of spinning off a sense of kind of almost a secular spirituality. There's that kind of sense to bring that kind of wonder and sense of commonality and purpose as human beings, as our birthright. So she's kind of working in that vein, I think. But she does quite a bit. So she's one of the more interesting characters. If there's no reason for you to be on Twitter, but if you are on Twitter, she's quite good. So people that interview her, that's one of the first things they should always say, I love reading your Twitter posts. They're so healing. You know, this guy, just the opposite of what you tend to get from Twitter, right? So, but they say, oh, it's just, I feel so good after reading your Twitter posts. Yeah, so it's this kind of, she does kind of a therapy approach to it. But she's very smart. She's very good, yeah. I wrote to her once and said, oh, so you're really talking about the Imago Dei, you know? And yeah, she's exactly, that's it. So there's enough overlap. I don't know exactly how she contextualizes that, but she's an interesting person. Chloe Valdery, okay.
It's the middle.
Okay, we're done with it. Okay, so now, I mean, again, there's no order, so this is just, you know, all over the map, so to speak, but one of, I think, our smartest kind of social critics right now is Wesley Yang. He is not a believer, but he was raised Methodist, thus that's why Wesley was given to him. And in his more recent writings, he talks about, you know, his own daughter, and he wishes he could give her the heritage that was given to him, even though he no longer affirms that heritage. But he sees this dilemma, you know, and a lot of, I'll talk more about this tomorrow, that's kind of a major point for me tomorrow, is a lot of these people have no foundation, whether philosophically or through religion, but they see the need for it, but they realize you can't just kind of grab onto it, right? There's some, a lot of them are atheists, right? And so they feel caught and trapped. So it's quite striking to read their writing, and they're very honest about it. Oh, I wish I could give my daughter what I was given, but what would that mean? I no longer believe this. But they kind of see, practically speaking, that it gave, when people, he was considered naive enough to believe in all this stuff, it gave them kind of a glue and a social coherence that we no longer have, right? So they're kind of trapped and caught, but he's very good at being able to talk about these things. The term that he came up with, there's a lot of terms being thrown around. We don't really have a phrase yet. I mean, wokeism seems to have called us to some degree, but a lot of people like his phrase. He's calling it the successor ideology, and a lot of people have latched onto that. It doesn't quite have a ring to it yet, but nevertheless, it's a term given to try to explain the change in values and mindset that has now happened. And it seems to be running every institution, pretty much, in our country. And so that's what he's calling it. And I can't do really justice to what, he's a beautiful writer, so he's a pleasure to read. And he does quite a bit on Substack, but if you read Wesley Yang, and I'll have a pretty good quote. It's pretty hard-hitting, you know, so I was thinking about what Doug was saying, and I got some hard-hitting quotes, but, you know, hopefully, you know. I mean, they're working kind of on the front lines of gender ideology, so it's not like a lobby setting or a church setting or a hospitality venue or whatever. I mean, they're pretty much doing battle, is the way they see it, with activists in today's world. So I think that's why a lot of their writing can be quite sharp. And so I think I'll probably mention that again tomorrow so that we put that all in context. But that's Wesley Yang. And so this is also a very interesting figure, Yoram Hazoni, who's Jewish, he's Israeli. He was trained as a political scientist at Princeton, and now lives and resides in Israel. So even, you know, he's Jewish, but very sympathetic to Christianity. I would say he's one of the sharpest people now who understand from a theological perspective that the attempts by all the people that I'm going to mention today, you know, are not going to work without a foundation, and he goes right to it. He also has a very provocative thesis dealing with the U.S. in terms of separation of church and state. So I'm just going to state it, and then you can ponder if you want, but his book just came out on it. But his thesis is basically there was never a separation of church and state in America, and that is a post-World War II reappraisal of the situation. So, and he's got his reasons why he thinks that. It's a really interesting kind of case to go through, which I haven't worked through all his logic for that, but it may help to explain the differences between the Enlightenment in Europe versus the Enlightenment, the way it played out in the US. But at any rate, he's very much a public figure, and I forget what they're called, but it was basically an organization of conservatives that got together in Florida, several months ago, I think, conservative intellectuals, and he formed a panel. So this, it came into play quite tellingly, because there were about five different people. He was one of them, he was the host, the moderator. But then you had, and I won't name them, but you had maybe, five individuals, three of them were probably Christian, two of them were not. Two of them were actually gay, and so it was an interesting kind of interplay, because from their point of view, they're thinking, okay, the kind of society that you think we should inhabit would not really allow us to exist, right? So, because they weren't just gay, but I think one of them was married and had adopted a couple of kids. And so they tackle these kind of thorny issues, but you can kind of see the dilemma, because they're agreeing in the sense of both wanting to combat the successor ideology or wokeism or whatever you want to call it, in order to, in their minds, politically save the country. Yeah. I mean, they take it very, very seriously. But then they wonder, if you bring in the religious question, doesn't that, just by definition, basically cancel us, you know? And so they go into an interesting thing, well, how can that work? You know, is there a way to make this work? But it's an interest. They don't solve that question on that panel, but what I liked about it is that it was put out there as a topic, okay? Because they're beginning to form alliances now. Hazzoni would tend to stand out, so I'll have a few projects I'll mention tomorrow morning of all of these individuals getting together. I mean, they're starting a university, basically, which is exciting in one way, but Hazzoni would say that has no chance. I mean, that's in his mind, that's going to succeed. There's no basis for it. Anyway, so that he's kind of the naysayer of the group. I mean, so he does that kind of function. But I think it's very, very good. If you want kind of a Christian analog to that, it would probably be Patrick Deneen, a Catholic kind of political scientist at Notre Dame. He was at Notre Dame. He might be at Georgetown now. But anyway, that he and Hazzoni are both very similar in that way, in standing for kind of a religious integrity that will make this a very difficult kind of project to work out. Oh, was that a hint? Yeah.
Yeah. How would you define he has no basis for it?
Well, the no basis?
There's no basis for it.
He would talk about the integrity of kind of the theological position. Right? So he's a believing Jew. And so there's that, kind of that tradition, and getting basically the knowledge, you know, from revealed text, you know, of being able to handle questions of what is male, what is female, all these, you know, source of authority, you know, for a culture, as well as a sense of schedule, like how to regulate one's life, how do you live, those kinds of things, you know. So I love reading him, because he's always talking about, you know, what he read in the Psalms this morning, and this, you know, he's always bringing up this stuff, and he can relate it to the contemporary world. But, and he does all the hard work in terms of making the connections with the political system as well. So he's not just kind of throwing loose ideas out there, like he's really thinking it through and thinks that this can work possibly, you know. But yeah, no, it's an interesting interplay, but Hazzoni would be someone to follow if you're interested in this. And Rod Dreher is definitely a believer. He's now Orthodox. I'll talk about maybe a little bit more about him tomorrow. He's interesting because, I mean, he's, you know, he was Catholic I think he was raised Methodist and became Catholic. And then for all the various things going on in the Catholic Church with sexual abuse, then he became Orthodox. And that's where he landed and remains right now. But he's actually got quite a bit of reformed kind of influence. So he is a heavy advocate of, if you're familiar, it's a little, I don't want to say outdated, but you remember Ken Myers and the whole Marcel Audio Journal, and he used to work for NPR, so he had kind of that NPR voice, you know, and he would read interesting kind of current books and break it down for people kind of in an NPR format. And he's still working and doing that, but he was an early forerunner of that kind of intellectual work, digesting kind of academic scholarly works for the layperson, basically, for the church. And who I believe is still sort of PCA, sort of minister. So he's been a heavy influence on Rod Dreher quite a bit. And I'll mention this too, so Carl Truman gets talked about a lot too. Rod Dreher has formed a strong relationship, friendship with Carl Truman, actually wrote the foreword to his book on the modern self. So I think he was unfortunately somewhat dismissed earlier on, because he wrote a book called The Benedict Option, and so, you know, if you're, I don't know who's reformed here or what, but if you're reformed, you hear anything about Benedict, or, you know, then you might think, okay, that's anti-culture, and it's not, you know, engaging in culture, and that's not what he was ever about, but he was seen that way as, you know, kind of an escapism. But it's interesting because of all the Christians that are working and publishing today, I would say he probably has the most voice and is picked up by atheists as well. So he's actually working in the public square, what remains of it, you know, and in a very kind of striking way. And I'll have more on that tomorrow as well. So he's one of, if you want kind of a new summary, I mean, he's very, very active. You could just tell what kind of person he must have been as a child, just a very verbal, right? So his posts are so long, and just write, he can just write and write and write, you know. And but he does a very good job at bringing you up to speed with some of the key issues that are going on in today's culture. This is a total switch in a way.
Is it up there?
Yeah, so Tristan Harris, some of you may have come across his work. Created a film called The Social Dilemma that a little while ago was making the rounds. So he used to be, I mean, he's one of these Silicon Valley kind of nerds, and worked at Facebook, but began to see the problems that I think now we identify in terms of the dilemmas with technology and social media, in terms of forming this kind of tribalism. And he does quite a bit of work on that. And maybe the most work right now in trying to get that message out there. And in particular with the last presidential election in the US, he's got some interesting kind of things to say about what happened to that in terms of the use of social media with algorithms and all that. So I'll treat that just very briefly tomorrow, hopefully, if I have enough time. But he formed an organization, I think, called the Center of Humane Technology. You know, it's based near Stanford, where he went to school. And it's pretty admirable for a young man. I mean, he's trying really hard. I mean, from where he's coming from, he's trying to save civilization, right? Like, he thinks technology, that kind of use of it anyway, has been so damaging to the country. And that's an interesting analysis. I mean, the division and the polarization that everyone is really familiar with now, he would, I think, put a lot of blame on that, on the rise of technology, right? I think a lot of us, I mean, especially if you raise teenagers, there's been kind of an acceptance of understanding how the rise of mental health issues seems to overlap very eerily with the rise of the use of personal cell phones usage, you know? I think when the rise of mental health, serious mental health kind of cases, broke maybe about 10 years ago among teenagers, it happened to be the year in which the use of cell phones exceeded 50%, you know, in terms of ownership of them among that age bracket. So, and there's a lot of other ways, though, that now people seem to be more savvy about connecting social media, phone use with even mental health issues. So he takes that a step further. And rather than think of it as individuals who are isolating and, you know, becoming alienated, he's thinking of entire groups in society that this is happening to. So I don't know how many of you have dealt with this in your own families, but you know, we were struck by that, even though we try to monitor and hold back the use of phones for quite a bit. But eventually, our oldest kid got, I don't know what you call them anymore, an iPod, like you just text, you know. And, but even that was incredibly damaging. Like, I mean, those seventh and eighth graders turned into like incredible monsters, right? Because they were able to attack each other just through texting. So they weren't even getting on the web. It wasn't that kind of use of it. But as a way of bullying and ganging up on people, like, it was incredible the way texting was used. So I think Tristan Harris's main thesis is that middle school isolating and bullying, that's now in the general population. That's what happened to society as a whole in terms of forming political alliances, you know. And that kind of rings true to me. It's an interesting kind of analysis. But anyway, he's got all the data on this stuff in his head, and so he's worth checking out as well. Yeah, do that. Okay. Another very interesting person, Brett Weinstein. I don't have his wife here, but he's married to Heather Hyen. They're both evolutionary biologists. So I'm going to keep track of time. So the thing he's known for a lot, if this reminds you, is he was a professor at Evergreen State College in Washington near Olympia. And a very liberal guy, right? So all these people are liberal it was several years ago, I think it was 7 or 8 years ago, the campus, through pressure from various student groups, decided to hold a No White Person Day. I don't know what exactly they called it, but that was the meaning of it, so that white people were not allowed to come onto campus that day. So he basically said, that's ridiculous, that's racist, I'm a Jew, I disagree with discrimination. So he continued to teach his classes. And what's striking is then you had these vigilante groups forming on the campus, and he was actually seriously in danger of his life. People were patrolling, trying to find him. Where is he teaching? We got to get him. I mean, it became this totally anarchic kind of situation on the campus. And then he eventually left, he and his wife, and they started doing a podcast, which is quite successful anyway, but he's maybe one of the senior people in this whole group that began to first write about these things. And 7 years ago, he said, you think this is just going to stick on Evergreen? This is going to happen on every campus, and it's going to happen in the culture. And it pretty much did what he said. And again, he has kind of a secular Jewish background, so it's interesting in that way, too. I'll try to talk a little bit more about him next time, and his wife, perhaps, too. I'm going to just move along here. So Melissa Chen is a very interesting figure to me. She's from Singapore, though I think now she has U.S. citizenship. So the interesting thing about a lot of these figures, and I'll have more of them tomorrow, they're scientists, okay? Including Melissa Chen. So she's, I think, called a computational biologist, whatever that is. But it's just interesting to me that a lot of the intellectual labor for this kind of work is coming from the science community. And she wanted to leave Singapore just because she found it too narrow, and so she admired the United States. So she's one of these people that is now seeing kind of a closing of that kind of open inquiry in U.S. academics and elite institutions. So she's doing everything she can, quite courageously, I think, to fight it. One of the things that she did is she created an organization called Books Without Borders. Books Without Borders. And she's gotten some of her fellow kind of Enlightenment scientist persons to be willing to have their work translated into Arabic. And she's making it available through download in various Arab countries. So the idea of trying to disseminate, so very much pro-Enlightenment, right? I mean, she also has kind of a Methodist upbringing that she now doesn't identify with, but she's very respectful about it. You know, it's interesting. So that's part of what she does. She also she formed an organization The acronym is just FAIR, but basically they're kind of a modern day ACLU, if that makes any sense. They feel that the ACU, the American Civil Liberties Union, has gone off track. And so they're actually now engaged heavily in legal work through getting lawyers to volunteer their time and effort and fighting key efforts, actually. So the most recent one is there was, I think, a claim of racial discrimination in New York City, and there was, I think, actually Minnesota to some degree, and there was one other state where they were withholding medical treatment depending on, prioritizing different sort of races for treatment. And Melissa Chen and her organization filed a lawsuit in New York, so that's just happened, so she's waging that war. So they're very involved, in that way. And then again, in her minds, they're trying to save the West, from their own point of view. She also, because she's from Singapore and she knows Mandarin, she's totally familiar with China. And so she's always really interesting to follow because she can come up with parallels. Okay, this is what's happening in China, this is what's happening here. She's very, very good at drawing those kind of analogies and hypocrisies on both sides on that one. And this is a friend of hers called Barry Weiss. So Barry Weiss is Jewish and is a practicing Jew in the sense that she attends synagogue. I don't know kind of how Orthodox she actually is, but she's most known for being a New York Times writer who, because of the changing climate, she felt that she wasn't allowed to really work there very freely anymore. I mean, she was getting these nasty emails and texts, with noose emojis on them, and just outright kind of threatening her in that way, with her Jewishness. And so she finally just called it quits and started writing for Substack and formed her own podcast, which actually is like one of the better podcasts that's out there. I think it's called Honestly by Barry Weiss. They're super fascinating, but she's a very high-profile kind of advocate on these kind of issues as well. Yeah?
Was she the one that was dismissed by the newspaper and then wrote a letter?
Yeah, that's her. That's her, so, she's pretty interesting. And there's a few people like that, but I think hers was the most notorious. It was maybe the first one that really came out that way. So look her up if you care to. This is Glenn Lowry. So he's a little different in that he's more senior. He's the first African-American PhD at Harvard. Okay, so he's in their economics. Now he's at Brown, I think, in the economics department there. So he is a Christian convert, though I wouldn't say it runs very deep in him. It's not like in his background, but super fascinating background. He grew up on the streets. He has this really hard kind of past, but he was a bright kid, and did really, really well. And it's just incredible. There's actually an interview by Barry Weiss of Glenn Lowry and all the stuff that happened in his life before he was even 16. It's incredible he even got to where he is now, But and he's kind of an in-your-face kind of person, so he just, he doesn't hold back, gets very emotional, and he's one of the clearest thinkers that we have, and is very articulate. And right now, he sees himself, he's probably in his, I think he turned 70 last year, so he said, I'm near the end, I'm not holding back at all, I am just going to go for it, what can they do to me? And then he's just, saying whatever he wants as clearly as possible. So it's quite stunning. And so he and a few other people do quite a bit of analysis on the especially with the George Floyd incident, with black crime and police brutality. And it's pretty interesting stuff that Glenn Lowry comes up with. But so he's a social scientist, but he definitely knows his stuff. He's very, very good. John McWhorter, he's a professor at Columbia. So he and Glenn Lowry are close friends. They do a podcast together, actually. John McWhorter has been a actually recently picked up by the New York Times as well as the Atlantic. So he's getting his name known. So he's probably the most public profile person we have, I guess, who is speaking, giving an alternate kind of reading of how to understand race relations in the United States.
Excuse me.
He's heavily in demand right now, but he's a musician as well, and I think at this point I might mention he and a few other blacks. I mean, they also want to go back to kind of Martin Luther King Jr. as a model in the whole civil rights movement. What's interesting to me about it is that none of them really have a very strong church or any church background whatsoever, right? So that was a very much church-mediated movement. Right? I'll try to show that tomorrow with the whole March on Washington. You know, those guys were wearing suits. The women were in dresses. Martin Luther King had Mahalia Jackson sing a couple of his favorite hymns. I mean, they were basically having church outside, okay? And even though these guys really admire Martin Luther King Jr., like most everyone, I'm not really sure like how far they can go with their project because they don't have that background. And they're very explicit about that. He goes, yeah, I'm an atheist, but I don't believe in any of those things. I mean, if anything, he believes more in theater, you know, kind of the culture thing of the arts and that kind of thing. But he believes in those principles. And so it's kind of an open question to me, like how successful can they be? But I guess we'll have to wait and see on that one. Yeah, Larry.
Is this the John McWhorter who also is a linguist?
Yes.
Who writes about language?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's his technical training is in linguistics. So he does lovely writing on the word use of words. And he actually has a whole thing on the use of the N-word, which is really interesting. But or like blasphemous language and just all kinds of, you know, but it's really, really, so he writes on a wide variety of subjects. But he's been tackling the kind of the race issue head on as well. And I just noticed that because he's now in the New York Times and Atlantic Monthly, he is getting picked up as a public figure on television, that kind of thing. So who knows? I mean, maybe he'll be able to use that platform to some degree. Okay, then this next figure, John Wood Jr., he is a Christian, a fairly recent Christian. So again, the roots don't go too deep in him. He's from Los Angeles. He started an organization called Braver Angels, that is getting more kind of notoriety now. So, and his goal is to bring opposing parties together in a forum, whether in a debate or a discussion. So he's kind of like Chloe Valdery in that way. I'm trying to bring both sides together and see how far that goes. His model is marriage counseling. So he sees it like, this is like, you know, bringing two parties that are estranged together and using those principles as a way of dealing with whether they're political differences or political philosophies. He occasionally runs for office. I think he ran as the Republican candidate against Maxine Waters, like, you know, for Congress for a while ago. But anyway, so his organization is getting picked up a bit more now too. So it's pretty interesting stuff. If you go to any of these people and follow their blogs or podcasts enough, you'll begin to see them all, because they kind of all reappear in each other's shows quite a bit. You know, but. Coleman Hughes, I'll try to race along a little bit more, or just end at a certain point. So Coleman Hughes is very young. He's probably, he graduated from Columbia, 2 years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago. Super bright guy, philosophy major. He was actually a student of John McWhorter's at Columbia. And at this point, he's speaking out against reparations for slavery, and he's got this whole logic about them. But he also helped form this organization called the 1776 Project with pretty much, I think, all black intellectuals to try to counter kind of the New York Times 1619 project. So, and I won't get into that so much, but anyway, so that's kind of what he's about. But he's different. He's a musician, so he plays various instruments in jazz clubs. I mean, he's quite good, actually. And now has some recordings that have just been released as well. But and he, I think he has, his podcast is probably where he puts a lot of his energy as opposed to writing itself. But he does write occasionally, too. But this is more for news stuff. We've kind of been interested, so there's this two, East Indian, born in Texas, Sagar and Jetty, and then Crystal Ball. So he's conservative, she's liberal. And they went on their own recently and formed a show called Breaking Points. And what they do, it runs, if you don't subscribe, it's like Monday through Thursday for about an hour and a half into different segments that you can get for free on YouTube. And they go through a digest of the day's news, or maybe what a day prior. And so it's a lot of commentary, but from two kind of different political positions. So it's kind of interesting. They both poke fun at their own perspectives. They don't identify with parties per se, but more Sagar will point out everything hypocritical about the conservatives, and Crystal definitely goes to town and tearing apart all, you know, the liberal side. So they kind of agree in those, in that way, in their negativity. And so that's kind of an interesting kind of news digest to get. So it just is another opportunity to get, because I think people look for maybe alternate news sources. That it's not news in the sense that it gives you everything that's happening, but I think of key issues, it's pretty interesting to go through the breaking points. Colin Wright, he's kind of like Brett Weinstein. He's also an evolutionary biologist, but very sympathetic to Christianity. He's an atheist, but I'll have some quotes by him tomorrow that's quite incredible, actually. Like, but people like him and other philosophers as well, though in public say we have more in common with evangelical Christians at this point than we do with, you know, with kind of the left, socially, in terms of the activist left. So it's really, really kind of intriguing to see the new kinds of alliances that are forming, so to speak, here. Wilfred Riley, he's a professor at University of Kentucky, I think in Louisville. So he's, I'm guessing he doesn't have a Christian background at all, but he's pretty poignant as a political scientist. So he's very prolific as well. So he's always commenting on whatever's happening. You know, you wonder how he even gets anything of his other work done, because he's constantly like engaged with everything that's happening on Twitter, at least. So, but I find his viewpoint pretty refreshing, pretty interesting. So, and especially on matters of slavery and other issues, it's intriguing. So I won't go on about Sarab Amari so much, but he's an interesting figure. He is a believer, right? So he was a secular Muslim that converted to Christianity. So he's a Christian, I think he's Catholic. And is kind of in the orbit of Roger, I would say, maybe, in that group of people. So in that university that I kind of alluded to, that all these people are forming, so he's on the board for that. So there are maybe three other Christians that I know of that are kind of serving as trustees or advisors for that project. So I'll talk about that a little tomorrow. But he has an interesting kind of, just because of his cultural background, I just find it kind of fascinating to find out more about what someone like him, as a secular Muslim who converted to Christianity, has to say about some of the cultural issues happening today. And then I'm getting near the end. So he's somewhat senior to Andrew Sullivan. I mean, he's a believer. He's been very, very vocal, kind of a supporter of a lot of these people. So he also broke away from the New Yorker magazine, actually, because he found it too stifling in terms of sort of like Barry Weiss, except Andrew Sullivan has a humongous following. So he started his own Substack subscription, you know, which I think is like $5 a month to subscribe, you know, and then you get their writings, whatever. And I mean, I'm sure that made him a millionaire. Like, he's just so prolific, you know, because everyone wants to read what he has to say. But he's one of the sharpest minds. I think he studied political philosophy at Oxford and then got a PhD at Harvard on that. But he's mostly known as a journalist. He was also a gay activist, but with critical with some of the more extreme activism. But he was very influential with Obama in trying to work through kind of liberalizing gay marriage. So that's kind of where he's coming from on a personal level, but felt that the movement went way too far in other ways too. So as you probably get the sense, it's a real mixed bag of people I have here, including this. So the Jacobin is the name of a journal, but it's also kind of a show that is run by, it's actually their socialists. And I think some of the clearest writing today is by socialists on what's going on culturally. The reason why is because they're more concerned about larger issues like class, right? So they're pretty allergic to these identity issues that are being touted and would have a heavy kind of critique of that approach as being very bourgeois in their minds. So it's interesting to go to, these are two of the hosts, there's another host that they have, but they'll tackle all these different issues, whether it's slavery reparations or something related to COVID treatment, or but they'll tackle it from a leftist socialist point of view. But it's very refreshing. It's really, really interesting to hear. And they'll take apart the idea of equity, and it's pretty refreshing. So if you want something like that, the main advantage is they use a class analysis, which I find very, very helpful as a way of understanding what's going on, you know. So they really use that quite powerfully to critique the current notion of diversity, equity, and inclusion as being basically kind of an elitist kind of ideology of a certain group of people that do that to each other, right, as opposed to having anything to do with truly disenfranchised people. Right? So it's a pretty interesting kind of critique that they have. And I'll close with somewhat senior too, Jonathan Haidt. He's a psychologist, a scholar. He wrote a book that was very popular a few years ago called Coddling of the American Mind. He formed an academic organization called the Heterodox Academy. And what's interesting is they're trying to bring in alternate points of view with it to the academy and try to bring in kind of not the mainstream view. So all these people are liberal, right, pretty much, except maybe Andrew Sullivan. He considered himself a conservative, maybe a few others. But Haidt's clearly on the left in a lot of areas. But he hates like what's been happening, at least in the academy, in terms of the control and the disavowing of free speech in order to promote a single point of view. And, so he goes about it. And he also has a kind of a psychological approach. So he was one of the early people to critique the use of cell phones for children, which I found kind of helpful. But, he goes through that. And he's raising somewhat older teenage girls right now in New York City. So it's interesting to hear him talk about parenting as well, like how they've dealt with that, the use of cell phones and that kind of. I think I close with that, but you know, and there are, of course, these are just kind of my favorite people, but there are more that I didn't really talk about. I mean, I could, you know, I guess focus more also on the Christian community, who are the writers, you know, in the church that are working on these things. I personally have found more support and intellectual interest in these figures, and some of them are Christians, but they seem to be doing more of the heavy lifting on these kinds of issues, you know. And I'm sure, you know, we have our contribution to make as well, right? Especially when you're dealing with actual people, like not just abstract issues that you're fighting against, you know. But they see very clearly what's happening and can articulate it in ways that are understandable enough to the outside world, you know. So they have a certain measure of respectability, I would say, even though they're definitely more of a countercultural voice in today. Okay, thank you very much. We just have a few minutes. I don't know if you have any comments or...